Unfortunately, within the Christian religion or faith here in India, the caste poison penetrated the Christian faith as well.
And it keeps us as slaves. We are still spiritual slaves, social slaves, and economic unequally suffering masses. Now, they say you should not look for God of universal nature. This is a problem.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, welcome to the show. I'm Justin Brierley, and today we'll be talking about Hinduism, caste, and Christianity in India. I'll introduce my guests in just a moment. Naturally, though, all thoughts for this last week have been turned to the Ukraine and the Russian invasion there. I know many people who are directly or indirectly affected by this. Premier Christian Radio has been covering it from many angles, politically and religiously. I myself am seeking to pull together at fairly short notice a show looking at the religious dimension of this conflict as well. There was a major split in the Orthodox Church a few years ago when the Ukraine Orthodox Church denounced the Russian Orthodox Church because of its close ties with Putin. So we'll see what we can do to bring you some thoughtful commentary and insight on Unbelievable into that situation next week. Just a reminder that this is your final call to register for our free Ask Philip Yancey Anything event on Tuesday the 1st of March. You can be part of a live online audience, ask your questions of the veteran writer and Christian thinker. And have you had a look at the lineup for our Unbelievable conference in partnership this year with ADF UK? It's happening on Saturday the 14th of May, live from the historic venue of the British Library in London. You can join in person or online from anywhere in the world. Our theme is God Unmuted, learning how the church can find its authentic voice again. I'll remind you who we're being joined by later on in the show, but one of my guests on today's show, Bishop Joseph D'Souza, is part of the lineup. So for both those events, Unbelievable 2022 and our Ask Philip Yancey Anything event this Tuesday, just visit unbelievable.live. Very excited about today's show. We're talking about Hinduism, caste, and Christianity in India. Both my guests joining me from India today. Joseph D'Souza is Bishop of the Good Shepherd Church in India and a civil rights activist there. And Bishop Joseph will actually be joining us at this year's Unbelievable Conference on Saturday, the 14th of May. Kancha Alaya Shepherd is a political theorist, human rights activist, and author of books, including his groundbreaking work critiquing the caste system in India, called Why I Am Not a Hindu. So today really isn't a debate, it's much more a mutual exchange on the social, political and religious issues dominating India. We'll be talking about the Hindu caste system and the plight of the Dalit Bahujan, how this has impacted the Christian church in India and the present religious tensions that exist in the country under the nationalist Hindu BJP party led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. So welcome Joseph and Kancha to today's show.
Thank you, Justin.
It's great to have you both. Been really looking forward to this. We've been working for a little while on setting up this conversation between you both, and it may well run to other conversations with other folk from the Global South in the future. But first of all, let's introduce you both. Joseph, tell us about your role as Bishop of the Good Shepherd Church in India and how many believers that constitutes within that network. And indeed, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about how many Christians there are overall on the Indian subcontinent.
The Good Shepherd Church movement is an Anglican church movement spread across the nation. We have nine dioceses across the nation and six Anglican bishops about to consecrate a new bishop this year. We are also in the process of establishing a diocese of the Middle East, where folk from there have approached us. And it's a movement that has come out of several, many decades of engagement with India in a holistic way. And it's an attempt to, and we'll talk about it, an attempt to work out what it means to be a church that is centered around the gospel of the kingdom of God and a church that is centered around the restoration of human dignity to all people. And so as a church, we do church, but we are very active in the field of education across the nation. For those who don't have the opportunity, the poor, the oppressed. We also involved in massive healthcare, and we've been in the front lines in terms of healthcare in the COVID situation. We also work against any form of sexual trafficking and work among communities. And then, of course, empowering women through economic development and a host of other people. In terms of civil society issues, we work with people of all faiths and no faith for upholding what we believe are the fundamental values of the Constitution of India. So we are grateful that India continues to be a democracy and that we can continue to exercise our faith the way we are doing now.
Hmm. And tell us a little bit about the Christian population in India. How many Christians are there estimated to be, and how many do you specifically have under your care in the Good Shepherd Church network?
Yeah, the Indian Christian population, according to the census, is supposed to be hovering around 2.3% or 2.5%. In a population of 1.3 billion, it does add up to quite a lot of people. At the same time, there is the recognition that there are a lot more Indians who are practicing the faith, who would not identify themselves openly as Christians in the census, etc., for a variety of reasons. So it's very difficult to say what is the size of the Indian church, but a safe number is to go by the census number and talk about 30-40 million people. We ourselves have tens of thousands of practicing believers across the nation in over 2,000 plus congregations spread across the nation, and include people from most of the major languages and traditions.
Well, that's a really helpful introduction to your background, Joseph, and the work you do, you know, across the board with the Good Shepherd Church Network. Really looking forward as well to having you at this year's Unbelievable Conference to represent a perspective from the Global South, which I think is so often missing very often in conversations. And I'm really glad to have this opportunity to explore some of the issues with yourself and Kancha today. Kancha, welcome to the show as well. Tell us a bit about your background. I know that this groundbreaking book, Why I'm Not a Hindu, came out about probably over 25 years ago now. And it really was a critique of the caste system in India. Tell us about your work in that regard and what that book was about, Why I'm Not a Hindu.
Well, I come from a very illiterate shepherd family from a very deep rural South India. And my parents, my siblings, all of them have been illiterate. Somehow I was sent to school along with my elder brother, which was a single teacher school under the tree. From there, I studied in Telugu medium up to high school at the regional level, and then came up to graduation at district level, and then came to my MA course to Hyderabad, where I now live, then in a university called Usmania. There I did my MA political science, MPhil, and also PhD. And it was during this whole period, I was facing all kinds of humiliations. around my physical formation, around my name, people can easily understand that I come from a very backward community within the what we call broad Shudras. I don't come from an untouchable family, but I come from a very low-end Shudra artisanal shepherd community. Now, added to this, when I was in the university where I studied, I also got a teaching job there. And during this course, the right-wing students and the left-wing students were conflicting with each other. And as a student, I was with the socialist movement. But gradually, I realized this Hindu religious fundamentalism was growing among the students, and it was threatening the first generation educated people, because the question of self-respect, the question of India reflects names, religion and caste backgrounds are reflected in the names also, or in the styles of living, clothes. So by 1990, when we were given first time reservation through a constitutional process, there was a huge backlash of Brahmins, who were the top caste, who were priestly community, and the other upper caste. Then we were trying to defend, I was one of the activists in that. But then we used to be verbally attacked, and our culture used to be attacked, and they were saying that we are incapable of becoming anything in educational system. It was then I thought of writing a book. Now, why we should be Hindu when we don't have the basic rights there? We can't go to the temple. If we go, we can't get into priesthood position, we can't read the book, though we are not untouchable. And we can't have the same body symbols that the Brahmins who are like the Pharisees of Israel have, you know, a thread across the body and all kinds of things. Then I thought of telling the country and the world that from childhood to death, how the Brahmins, the Banyas, who are the richest now doing the monopoly capitalist business, and both Narendra Modi also comes from that background, though he took an OBC certificate. So how all of them exploit us and make money and then educate themselves in foreign countries and come back and exploit us. So this book tells from my childhood to my community's death, their childhood to their death. And we have historical gods and goddesses of our own, and which have broadly some sort of a, you know, vague kind of linkages to the ancient civilizational practices, where perhaps people must have thought that God is one, but reflects in several forms, but mostly in the production forms. You know, a goddess is like a doctor or a tank builder or a water storer or, you know, so many other things. Whereas their gods were having weapons and came from books. So then this, after this book came, there were a lot of abusive attacks through writing and through, you know, small physical kind of attempts. But the book became bestseller within a year. And even now, it is one of the bestsellers across India. And it has really changed the discourse on Hindu religion.
Well, this is why I'm so interested in having you on, Kancha, alongside Joseph today, because of this voice you have given to these lower castes, and you yourself, as you said, are from the Shudra caste, Which, as you say, is not the untouchable caste, which at least a number of people are aware of, the Dalit community in India. But many people just simply, and I include myself here, are fairly unknowledgeable about the caste system in general. Perhaps you could give us a very quick lesson in the caste system. As I understand it, there is the Brahmin caste. I may mispronounce these, the Kshatriya caste, the Vaishyas, the Shudra and Dalit in general terms. Do you want to sort of give us an explanation of what those are and what social standing, if you like, is involved with each type of caste in the Hindu system?
You know, India is a very ancient civilization. Goes back to 6,000 to 7,000 agricultural civilization. But when the Aryan migration took place around 1500 BCE, they came as a war heroes to India, and the remaining, the indigenous population were basically agriculturists and animal grazers and producing food for themselves and shipping, fishing and, you know, hunting. The first change occurred through to establish caste when the Brahmins have written a book called Rig Veda. They claim this, that Rig Veda is as old as the Old Testament and the Genesis section. In that they said, God created human beings unequal into four categories. So Brahmins, those who can read the books, those who can do the priesthood, or those who should not touch any productive work, they should not soil their hands. Then the Kshatriyas were supposed to rule the country or people. The Vaishyas are supposed to do the business. The Shudras were supposed to produce food and serve the three higher hegemony, higher groups. There was no Dalit community at that time. So as time went on, the Brahmins declared that leather production, leather work is more untouchable than tilling of the soil or producing food. And they were, leather workers were made untouchable. And so it is exactly like, you know, at the Jesus times, there were Pharisees, there were Gentiles. The Shudras were like Gentiles, doing all the work, and but they are not from outside, but within India, and the most indigenous people historically. And like Samaritans, these untouchables. And their water is not touched, their food is not touched, and they are not supposed to come inside. So these four communities were divided into further castes as the time went on, and they wrote their own books we were not supposed to read. Now the tragedy is the Shudra population is 52% of the total population. And that means it works out roughly about 750 million people and more. And they don't have the right to become the priest. They don't have the right to read the scripture in Sanskrit language at the early stages and become anything in the philosophical, spiritual domain. So the Dalits are untouchables. The constitution tried to abolish this untouchability, but not the caste system. So as a result, what happens is, the fear of the Brahmins is, after Christianity came in the first century, caught up more in the down south, then in the 7th century, Islam started. The fear of there says that if the Shudras become either Muslim or Christian, they were afraid of they becoming more Muslims at one time. Now they are afraid of they becoming Christian now, because Christianity is an evangelical religion now. Islam is not. So if that happens, India will become a major non-Hindu country. and which is only country situated between the Muslim 56 countries on the one side, the western side, and the Buddhist countries on the eastern side. And somehow there is no eastern big nation, Christian big nation in the east. So they think that this will go perhaps to Christianity if the Shudras realize and get education, particularly English education. So that becomes the issue of, you know, anti-minority campaigns. Yeah, so there is a fear that my Shudra communities and the Dalits, more and more Dalits are going into Christianity now. So there's a very famous reformer called Ambedkar, who studied in Colombia and came here, and he wrote the constitution. And he embraced Buddhism as against Hindu religious practices. But after he embraced Buddhism, what the right-wing RSS BJP people sees, more and more Dalits became Christians, not Buddhists. So Ambedkar has opened the lock of the right to conversion, and people see Christianity as a better option. So that is where the problem are then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me come back to you, Joseph, and that's such a helpful description of the way the caste system has developed historically and the current issues that exist. If you don't mind me asking, Joseph, which caste have you been part of yourself?
I'm from the upper caste, Justin.
And even if you are not necessarily a Hindu, you are obviously a Christian, does your caste still, if you like, apply? It's just a kind of social fact, if you like, on the Indian continent.
Not really, because Christianity is seen as a non-Indian thing.
Okay.
By those who follow the caste system, but within the Christian religion or faith here in India, the caste poison penetrated the Christian faith as well, and just like racism penetrated the Western Christianity, caste has also poisoned Indian Christianity. So, which is an anathema if you believe in the gospel of the kingdom of God, where, you know, in Christ there is no upper caste and low caste. But the fact that there is caste in the church makes it a very, very problematic one. And so, over the years, for 30 years now nearly, following the examples of great Christian reformers like Wilberforce and Lincoln and others, I have been led to raise my voice and expose the casteism within the church and call out the church in India, and of course call out the church in the West for their racism, but for casteism in the Indian church. And so there's a whole chapter devoted to that in one of my books about caste in the church.
To what extent has the Indian government over the years been successful or not successful in redressing the discrimination against lower caste Indians?
Well, in 1950, we adopted the new constitution. And over a period of time, undoubtedly, the anti-untouchability struggles of the reformers and education, partly because of the Christian missionary education that went more into the Dalit communities, not so much among the Shudras. Say, for example, we are shepherds, which is a large community in India, but we are hardly handful of shepherds can speak English and write English, but there are a number of Dalits. So reforms are happening during the Congress regime under the rubric of secularism and pluralism and so on. There was some kind of social change, at the same time, you know, holding on to the hegemony of the Brahmins and others in the spiritual domain, in educational domain, and so on. But side by side, the right-wing Hindus were organizing again as the change. And that right-wing Hindu struggled to come to power, though mainly projecting themselves as anti-Muslim because of the partition of the country in 1947. Because Pakistan and Bangladesh was part of us at that time. And Muslim population in 1947 was around 34%. So after that, they became more alert and they stopped particularly the Shudras and Dalits getting into English medium education. How did they do that? They got English medium education through private schools. Even the Christian missionary schools and entrepreneur schools, monopoly houses started their own school. We had no access. We had to go to government school, only study in regional languages. Therefore, we could not understand the world. We could not understand the transformation. For example, I myself did not get English education in any English medium school or in Christian missionary school. I learned on my own in the process of my education. So there is change, no doubt. And because of the change, there is more fear among the Brahmins and others, because change always can ask for equality, as it did in America. Because the American Civil War, after 100 years of independence, came through the English medium and the Christian Church of the Blacks. And Martin Luther King emerged there. So they are now afraid of our education in English. So that is the reason why my friendship started with Joseph. I requested him to start English medium schools in villages for Shudras and Dalits. One such school is started 20 years back in my village. And now you can see that small village producing high quality engineers, high quality, you know, from Adi tribals, from Dalits, from OBCs. So there is change, and there is this checkup to that change. There is a check to that change. And the bigger check is from the right wing right now, from power position.
Okay. Well, we'll delve into this more in the next segment of today's show, and particularly the way that the Christian Church has been involved in these social changes. And, you know, I know that there has been a large influx from especially the Dalit community into the Christian Church, but that's obviously comes with its own, religious tensions that exist. So we'll be exploring this more as we continue today's show. You're listening to an edition of Unbelievable, looking at Hinduism, caste and Christianity in India. My two guests are Bishop Joseph D'Souza and Kansha Ilya Shepherd. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show, talking about Hinduism, caste and Christianity in India. My guests are Joseph D'Souza, Bishop of the Good Shepherd Church in India, and Kansha Ilya Shepherd, who's a political theorist, human rights activist and author of books including Why I'm Not a Hindu. So we've heard obviously about the caste system in Hinduism, Joseph, and some of the issues regarding that, the untouchables, the Dalits and so on. And that there's been a big movement really to have recognition of rights, education and so on for these communities. To what extent, though, has this, you know, been, I understand there's been quite an influx of people from the Dalit community, perhaps also the Shudra community, to Christianity. What's your thoughts on that? What have you seen happen in the last few decades?
It's not just in the last few decades. Historically, Justin, there is this great attractiveness of Jesus Christ and the message of Jesus Christ and the life of Jesus Christ to a wide section of India's population. Because even though Christians have not articulated properly, because Jesus in the gospel of the kingdom offers one humanity as a message of salvation, that in Christ, we are one, and dignity and equality is given to us. And then there's this phenomenal teaching in the Bible and in the New Testament that we're all created in the image of God. And then, of course, the unconditional love of Jesus. So historically, from ancient times, this has attracted sections of the Indian population to Jesus Christ, and a good section among the so-called Dalits, tribals, and even the Sudras have turned to faith in Jesus Christ. We also have the phenomena in certain parts of the nation where upper caste people have turned to faith in Jesus. And women especially have turned to faith in Jesus. And so it has not been, as the propaganda goes, through any forced campaign or a fraudulent means, but it is the voluntary choice of people to find what makes a sense to them and to find the God that gives meaning to their life. So, yes, the downtrodden, not just in India, around the world, the working class and others like in England during the awakening and all, always find the message of Jesus and the life of Jesus very appealing, and the notion of his unconditional love very, very powerful. And so the voluntarily, they turn to faith in Christ.
Mm. Now, that is obviously what you've seen happening, obviously from the perspective of the Hindu Nationalist Party, the JBP and so on. They're very concerned, it would appear, at this kind of movement. So what has that looked like for you as a pastor on the ground in terms of the kind of pressures that the Christian church is facing? Are you able to freely speak of faith, to evangelize and so on?
It's become very, very difficult in the last couple of decades. We have become the target of a vicious demonization campaign on this issue itself of people embracing Jesus Christ. And consistently, I've been saying, and we have been saying, that the Christian church in India, and so for that matter, the Christian church around the world, we are living in 2021 or in the 21st century. The idea of forced conversions or fraudulent conversions is anathema to the Christian world. Most of the sane Christian world would not agree to anything like this. And so categorically, we are against any forced and fraudulent conversions, and I would be myself very uncomfortable if somebody says he wants to become a Christian for some ulterior motive. I mean, it's just not on. The other thing is, you have to recognize this kind of an allegation could have made sense when we are under the colonial rule. But for the last 70 years, we are no more under the colonial rule. This is a country ruled by Hindus, and all of the levers of power are with them. How on earth could Christians even think of engaging in forced and fraudulent? I'm talking about Indian conversion. It's not possible. And the other thing is that despite all of the anti-conversion laws, we yet have to see a case where a group has been engaged in forced and fraudulent conversions and has been convicted by a court. That has not happened. And so yes, the extremists may find it very difficult to understand what's going on here when people embrace Christ. And I think the phenomenal problem for the Hindu extremist is not understanding the whole dynamic of what happens when people embrace and decide to follow Jesus Christ. The spiritual dimension, the social, the intellectual dimension. There is no concept in them, in their understanding, that these are all voluntary experiences people are having with Jesus Christ, and no amount of pressure or anything is going to frighten these people who have embraced Jesus Christ. So yes, the attacks are there, but it's very difficult, and especially this last Christmas season and all, it has been horrendous in the state of Karnataka. And sadly, the other fear, of course, is just really a historical misunderstanding about what evangelization is supposed to do or achieve. There is this nonsense going around, which I have challenged, of the whole thing of a Christian nation. There is no agenda anywhere, either with Christians in India or around the world, of turning any nation into a Christian nation. And there's no, I mean, Jesus said there's no such philosophical, theological base. So there is this fear. I can categorically say that even if significant numbers of people turn to faith in Jesus Christ, the idea of us having a politicized, political Christian nation in India is not on the minds of any Christians, here or abroad.
And the problem, though, in a sense, Kansha, is that there is obviously a significant aspect of the ruling class who want to see India categorized as a Hindu nation, and therefore would see anyone of another faith as somehow, you know, not representing true Indian, you know, cultural heritage and everything else. I mean, your view, as I understand it, Kansha, is that for you this is a relatively recent idea that Indians are automatically somehow Hindu if they are born into, you know, the Indian sort of subcontinent or way of life. You think and that's why you have rejected the label Hindu yourself, as I understand
but
it, Kansha.
The issue is that if Hinduism is being defined by the right wing as a religion, like Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, and so on, we all should have the right to religion, which is now lacking. That as a Shudra, one is a tiller, one is a pot maker, one is a cattle grazer, you know, the Dalits are leather workers or labor and so on. Now, how they cannot become priests in the temple? Now, many religions as of now are allowing only men. That way, even Christianity is struggling with women coming into the higher positions of priesthood. But even the men from these castes cannot become a priest. Now, what does it mean that we are Hindu? We don't have the right to read the scripture, learn about it. And they say that only Sanskrit should be the language of God, which Islam also thinks that Arabic should be the language of Allah. Now, Christianity somehow overcame that. Any language is language of God. Now, this certainly is an attraction to people who are denied access to the idea of God. Now, their fear is that if the Shudras, the Dalits, and the tribals, if they get educated, they will either ask for equality in Hinduism totally, because if they are saying that, you know, this is the form of Hinduism, they will either ask for that, which they are not prepared, or they will go into something else. Because my feeling is, still human mind in the world is ruled by God more than the state or state laws. God is a significant ruler of human mind. Now, from that chunk of, you know, God-controlled people, the Shudras, Dalits, you know, tribals who constitute about, let us say, 800 more million people. Now, how can you keep them ignorant in 21st century with a globalized economy? Now, their problem is that we should be still slaves spiritually and producing economic goods and commodities for their well-being. But now we challenge. Because this is exactly the challenge of the Dalit Shudra OBCs in India. What Jesus' time shepherds, fishermen, and others challenged the existing religious power of Israel. Now, in my view, there was a caste system in Israel. Except the Pharisee, nobody could become the high priest. Jesus himself was not allowed to start his preaching in his own birthplace. So, we were kept ignorant. We were treated as human body, but not human as human mind. But now, after independence, fortunately for us, there was a Dalit, great reformer. And that reformer injected in us that you are also equal in the eyes of God. Now, this is the challenge. I have been asking repeatedly, either you give us equality in all the temples, the right to read, establish schools, colleges to study, theological systems, as you prescribe the syllabus, our children will be ready for that. If they want to go elsewhere, now then how do you stop? Because God is universal. God is not national. Whereas the Hindu right-wing people, this is only religious group in the world, the Brahmins. In whatever political formation they are, in whatever religious structure they are, they think that Indian God is different. Indian God is a nationalist God. Now this we contest. God can never be a nationalist. God is universal. If there are more than 80-90 Christian countries, more than 56 Muslim countries, and there are about 10 Buddhist countries, China, Japan, Korea, you know, so on. And why Hinduism remained only here? And it keeps us as slaves. Yeah. We are still spiritual slaves, social slaves, and economic unequally suffering masses. Now, they say you should not look for God of universal nature. This is a problem.
Well, so do you welcome the fact that many people in the Dalit and Shudra community have turned to Christianity? Do you see that as a positive thing overall, Kancha?
No, I would say that people sought a solace even in the utter poverty in the realm of God on equal basis with a book in the hand and a God's prayer and so on. But what they did was very interesting. When they gave us a reservation, they said only Hindu Dalits and Hindu OBCs will get reservation. If somebody takes, more than 50% of Dalits, Christian Dalits today, don't have the right to reservation.
What do you mean by a reservation? Just for my benefit.
It is an affirmative action for getting prioritized education and prioritized jobs, like the blacks in America. And so they said, if you are not within the Hindu fold as unequals, if you go into Islam or into Christianity, you are not eligible for getting this preferential treatment. But the people who became Christians, the Dalits, their poverty does not get upgraded, changed within a day, within years. They still remain Dalits in the villages. Because unfortunately, the church in India was also casteist. The Brahmins who became Christians in the 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century, did not become casteless. They operated in the caste mode. They did not give us English education. Catholic institutions mainly educated the upper caste. So this is the problem. Now we need to work for a global agenda of removing caste inequalities from this land itself, as we are determined in the domain of God itself, that we are determined to remove race inequalities through United States, through other forms of expressions and struggles and so on. But we don't get universal support. We don't get Western support. See, how can somebody be converted with for some dollars? That is not possible. Human beings do not get into a new religion because you are getting few dollars. It is a question of human being and God relationship.
Joseph, just to bring you in on this, I mean, do you see, I mean, obviously in the last couple of years, there's been a great focus on racism in the USA, the George Floyd protests and the Black Lives Matter movement and so on. I mean, do you see this as if you like, India's sort of racist equivalent? And to that extent, is there enough being done on an international level to recognize the kind of discrimination that is happening?
Justin, I see globally, one of the defining issues of our time, of this decade, our next couple of decades, is the issue of racism and caste. And it touches all of us. It touches the West, it touches the East. Because there is a convulsion going on in societies everywhere. And of course, the symptoms may be polarization, violence, this, that, and the other, the Black Lives Movement everywhere. But across societies, including in India, there is a deep, deep yearning in the human spirit for human dignity and equality. And unfortunately, the world has, the global audience has not grasped up until now the insidious nature of caste. And finally, of course, this lady Wilkinson, black lady, wrote the book called Caste in the US, became a bestseller. And she finally hit the nail on the head when she sees the roots of racism is based on the ideology of caste. She says racism is just the flesh and bones, but caste defines you by birth. Doesn't matter what you achieve in life, what education you get, who you are born as is what defines you. It's not even, you know, as some have sought to do, a matter of skin color. You know, racism is not merely a matter of a black and white race. It is more fundamentally, do you believe all human beings are born equal or not? And history shows that we as humans will not give other humans the same value and dignity. So it's an age-old problem, but because of modern technology and globalization and all, this yearning has come to the fore. And whether the Hindu extremists want to accept it or not, caste as a form of racism is also now understood by more and more people. And it is in India's best interests. In fact, for those who want to even preserve Hinduism, it is in Hinduism's, I mean, when I use the word Hinduism, I'm using it in the classical sense, okay, not in the current form it is understood. It's in everybody's best interest, and especially in India's best interest, that caste is dealt a mortal blow and we come out of this curse that has been inflicted on our nation.
Can you simply leave it behind, though? Because it sounds to me that as though it is very much baked into Hindu theology. I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Kantra or Joseph, but as I understand it, obviously in Hinduism, there is this belief in karma, in reincarnation, and to that degree, caste is seen as a sort of, you know, an effect of a life that you have lived, and then you live in this particular caste, and therefore it's, you know, it's divine justice, it's karma and so on, if you have been born into these lower castes and so on. So can that simply be, can you get rid of that if that's very, very much part and parcel of the Hindu philosophy?
So, you see, the way, I think there are many battles going on. One is, of course, the battle for the soul of Indian civilization and what the Indian civilization represents vis-a-vis what the Hindu extremists are trying to tell us. Okay. Now, yes, caste and all of that is linked to a specific version of Hinduism that's been fostered on the nation for a long, long time. But I can't see why India as a nation cannot reject the caste system, which does mean dismantling a lot of the systems, of course, and that's very thing. But for the greater good of India and the Indian people, of course, the sheer numbers that we have been told today, huge numbers of people cannot be consigned to this kind of secondary living. So I am one who feels that because India, though the demographics and all say in what way is India a Hindu nation? You know, is India monolithically Hindu? No. Is Hinduism monolithic? No. Some are trying to make it. India is an amalgamation of tribes, as we have seen the original caste, those Dalits, then now we hear about the Sudras. So can it be thrown away and reject? And can a movement rise that says ideologically this is not on? The constitution has given us a great footing. It needs to go further, but it can be fought. I'm one who believes because caste has infiltrated Christianity. Correct me if I'm wrong. Caste has infiltrated the other religions in India too. So we all have a common battle on our hand as Indians, regardless of our faith, saying, how do we check it out? And if in the process of checking it out, we have to reform some of our theology and some of our understanding, just as Kancha just referred to the ordination of women as priests, let's work on it. So I am one who feels it can be done, but it has to come from within the system. We as Christians from outside cannot do it. It has to come within the social structure of what is Hinduism or India right now for that kind of an impetus to, I think the women are going to be extremely key to this. Other progressive forces are going to be extremely key to it. People like Kanchi are going to be extremely key to it. But it has to go. Justin, it has to go for the sake of India and the sake of the world.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment to conclude this discussion today on Hinduism, caste and Christianity in India. Joining me today, Bishop Joseph D'Souza and Kancha Ilya, Shepherd, and we'll get some concluding remarks as well on the future of religion and culture and society in India towards the end of today's show. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show. And before we get to the end of the show, Nigel Bovey will be joining me to talk about an exciting new set of webinars being hosted by the Christian Evidence Society throughout March. Also coming up later on tonight on The Profile, distinguished bioethicist John Wyatt joins Megan Cornwell to talk about his life and faith. That's also available, of course, via The Profile podcast. And in fact, I'm planning to bring you a show soon with John Wyatt and his son, Tim. They are the father and son combination behind a new podcast, Matters of Life and Death, looking at issues of biology, science, technology, reproduction, all from a Christian perspective. That's joining our suite of podcasts from Premier Unbelievable. Really excited about Matters of Life and Death. In fact, you can go and subscribe straight away if you want. Well, they'll be joining me on a show soon to talk about the ethics of reproduction, including the surrogacy industry, which in fact has up until now been quite prominent in Ukraine. We'll be looking at that new podcast as well that we're launching with them. So look out for that. John is a renowned bioethicist, John Wyatt, and actually also one of our guests at Unbelievable the Conference 2022. He'll be bringing his expertise in how Christians can speak into the whole world of medicine and science with grace and truth. As we know, culture's been racked by not just the COVID virus, but by the fallout over vaccines and mask mandates and so on. Many churches and Christians caught up in all of that and the politics of it. Well, John's a great voice to help us find a path through those issues. Again, if you want to get your tickets for the conference, it's available now. Unbelievable the Conference, Saturday the 14th of May, in partnership with ADF UK. Find out more at unbelievable.live. Next week here on the show, working on a response to the Ukraine invasion, a look at the religious dimension of this and the tensions that have played out in the Eastern Orthodox churches alongside it. Our prayers and thoughts, of course, are with all affected. I know we have show listeners in the Ukraine, but we will try and bring you some thoughtful commentary on that on next week's show. And finally, don't forget our Ask Philip Yancey Anything event coming up this Tuesday, your last chance to register. Unbelievable.live is the place to do it. You can join in with the questions for Philip Yancey. And by the way, I'm hosting a separate follow-up chat with Philip straight after that webinar for anyone who wants to support the launch of our new wider Premier Unbelievable ministry later this year. We're going to be sharing our vision for the future. So if you want to be part of that follow-on event to meet Philip, hear more about our plans and vision, just email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you can't make the date but still want to hear about the plans, still email. We'll make sure you hear about it. Again, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I've also actually included a link from today's show where you can simply register for that follow-up event too. If you've registered for the webinar, that doesn't mean you'll be able to access the follow-on event. I should have said that in previous weeks, actually. You'll need to register separately to come along to our after party, as it were. So if you want to do that, the link is with today's show, or email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Right, into the final part of today's conversation. So we've been talking today about Hinduism, caste and Christianity in India. And by the way, I will leave links from today's show to both of my guests, Bishop Joseph D'Souza and Kancha Aliya Shepherd, and the books as well that have been mentioned, Why I'm Not a Hindu and others that Kancha has written. And I know Joseph has also authored books as well. Joseph will be joining me along with many others for Unbelievable the Conference this year, Saturday the 14th of May. So do check out the notes with today's show as well for more on that. Kancha, thank you for the time that you've spent sort of talking about the history of India, the caste system and so on. What about the future? I mean, do you feel like there is still a lot of resistance to this movement that you've been part of to see equal rights for lower castes? Do you think that the momentum is in your favour, that you will see change in India? What's your view on the future here?
Well, Justin, I am very hopeful because of two reasons. One, this democracy and the constitution that we accepted now gives us the right to educate ourselves and to look at the world and see the change that is happening all around. I'll give you one example. If you look at the screen of three of us, as you ask the question of race, you are of one color, Joseph is of another color, I am of another color. So he must have come from a Brahmin heritage a long time back, and you are a white European. I look like a black in this, even this. But the question is, do I have equal right or not? We have taken this question to United Nations in 2001, the Bern Conference. And Indian government did not allow us to table the resolution, and the UN also did not accept because the countries did not support us for abolition of birth-based inequality. So, but yet, it somehow we fought through, and then whatever the right-wingers are trying and whatever the liberal upper castes are stopping us in whatever way they could, because media is in their hands, educational institutions are in their hands, and the global linkages are in their hands, yet we could make caste and untouchability a global issue now. And that is the reason why American universities today say put caste discrimination as an issue of their campuses. And even Britain hopefully will do. But what is important is in this globalized world, when our Prime Minister went and met Pope, the present Pope, and then he invited him to come to India, his own party people were trying to attack him. Why are you inviting a Pope who gave a call for, you know, a Christianization of the East in the 21st century? Now, the question is, nobody can stop this. My hope, other hope comes from English education. And that is where my association with Joseph started, as I said earlier. Now, once the world realizes we need English as a language to communicate between one end of the tribal child, a Dalit child, a Shudra child, and the world in this internet era, I think liberation will happen. Liberation will happen in the spiritual domain. Liberation will happen in the social domain. Liberation will happen in political and economic domains. Because after all, God created the idea of equality. Even the Christian idea of God was different before Martin Luther. But Martin Luther changed that idea of God, that God created the idea of equality along with human beings and idea of dignity of labor. You know, by biblical God saw the universe and worked for 6 days, he worked for 6 days and seventh day he rested. That is the work culture. And then Cain and Abel were, one was a shepherd and one was an agriculturist. So they had the work culture there, and we need to build similar spiritual equalitarian idea among our people. If we can speak English from one end to another end, all our people can communicate in one language. You know, I'm very impressed with one statement of Jesus, the Last Supper or some other, that a day will come when all human beings will speak one language. Human beings will communicate with each other. Now that we don't have right now. So let us hope that the whole world will come to our rescue, will see our problem. Definitely, I am hopeful about the change in India.
And how about you, Joseph? Are you hopeful in the same way?
I'm hopeful, and yet it depends. You know, what looking at the global forces at play, I think it a lot depends upon the Christian Church. You know, unfortunately for us, Justin, we have been so used to a gospel whose main business is to take us up to heaven and then leave us totally unconnected with the issues of the world. And whereas the gospel always is the spiritual becoming physical, God creates the earth, the spiritual being creates the earth. This God becomes man and he comes on the earth. I mean, we have got it all upside down because of a cultural bias. And so if the church is not engaged with the issues that matter, and at this particular time and for this conversation, it is the issue of human dignity, justice, and human equality. It doesn't matter whether somebody is a Christian or comes to Christ or not, but if righteousness and justice reigns, the kind of Christianity I believe is that my God is glorified in that. The Christian God is glorified. And in the glorification of the biblical God is the testimony to the power of the gospel of the kingdom of God. And so if the church does not stay as a bystander when the whole world goes through all kinds of issues, and I'm not saying the church has always been a bystander. I know in the early centuries, when all the plagues sort of hit, the church was there right in the front. And somehow the church has to get out of living in a bubble where they are worried about their safety first, rather than getting involved in the struggles of people. So whether it is the equality of women or the equality of children, the church has to deliver on what the gospel is talking about. The more the church becomes more active and delivers, we can be hopeful. But at the same time, when I said that as I said, depend, the forces of extremism are running rampant, and there seems to be no control. And I'm worried that something may trigger massive violence in some part of the world, here in India, in some other part of the world. And human hate now against each other is reaching a peak. And unless something of the kingdom is brought into society and there are the peacemakers whom Jesus wanted, we might have to go through some convulsion before we realize, man, what have we set loose? So that concern is there, and I can't ignore that concern, not just for India, but other parts of the world where hate seems to be on the rise in multiple ways. So I'm hopeful because the gospel is about hope.
Look, it's been great to be able to spend some time with you both and to hear about these important issues. I'm aware that we could only scratch the surface in many ways of what's going on in India. But yeah, it's great to hear of the work that your own church network is doing, Joseph, in this regard, and your own activism as well, Kancha. And I will make sure there are links to both of you for anyone who wants to pursue this further and support the work that you're both doing. But for now, thank you very much for being with me on today's show.
Thank you very much, Justin.
As ever, you can get in touch with the show by emailing us unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also send me your feedback via our Twitter account. I'm on @unbelievablejb. You can find the show Facebook page at facebook.com/premierunbelievable. And all the ways to get in touch are with the website, of course, premierchristianradio.com. www.patreon.com/unbelievable. Many more podcasts and videos that you can discover there. And today's show, of course, available via our YouTube channel. Thanks for all the feedback that's come in regard to recent editions of the show. People enjoyed the interaction between Paul van der Klee and James Croft on last week's show, talking about godless communities, godless churches, and their future. The Common Toad tweeted me, both you and Paul have been instrumental in my surprised realization that the quality of the discussions and arguments were actually higher and livelier inside the tent than out. Great to see this conversation go up. And Kyle said, Justin, as always, this was great. We appreciate so much the content and the spirit of the engagement itself. People are craving this kind of interaction between and among interlocutors who may very well disagree on almost everything, except that it's good to have I-thou exchanges. Thanks for the support. But wrapping up the feedback a little early today, because I want to introduce you to a special guest. Well, I'm pleased to be joined now by Nigel Bovey, who is part of the Christian Evidence Society, and they are beginning a new series of Questions of Our Times webinars in March. On Tuesday evenings throughout March, you'll be able to follow the science, exploring some of today's big questions with leaders in the fields of physics, astrophysics, social robotics, and in the whole religion and science debate. It's a really exciting series coming up very soon. Nigel, welcome along. Tell us a little bit about Questions of Our Times. This isn't the first time you've run these webinars, is it?
Yeah, thank you, Justin. Yes, good to be with you. Indeed, this time last year, we ran a first series of webinar conversations where I spoke with invited guests about what we call questions of our times. Last year, we interviewed, for example, the likes of Jonathan Aitken, where we talked about fake news and media. We talked with the late departed Reverend Joel Edwards about issues concerning race and racism. And the likes of Dr. Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury. We talked about the concept of spirituality and how spirituality differs maybe to people who have a Christian faith. That series went very well. It's available on the Christian Evidence YouTube channel. So if anybody wanted to see or get a flavour, a taste of the kind of conversation we have, then it's readily available. And this year we felt as a society that we would like to revisit that format. And so we have four, as you say, very exciting topics and very exciting guests coming up in March. We start with the Reverend Dr. Alistair McGrath, who is a scientist and he's professor at Oxford University. We should be talking on the subject of why should we always follow the science. We then go on to interview Dr. Mary Ellen Foster from Glasgow University, who is an expert in what is known as social robotics. And then we wonder whether robots will ever actually take our jobs. That's the main thrust of that one. And then we talk with Dr. Barbara Drossel, who is a physicist from Darmstadt University. We talk about whether we are here in the universe by accident or whether it's here by some sort of sense of design, whether there is a God and what kind of God he might be like. And then we finish off our series on the 22nd of March with astrophysicist Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, who has worked on most of the major telescopes in the world, including Hubble. And we're going to ask her whether we are alone in the universe. We know that there are extra planets that are being discovered. Are there other universes as well?
It sounds like a really exciting lineup, Nigel. Why these particular issues, though, at this particular time? Why did you want to bring these issues around science, the universe, robotics at this particular moment to a new audience?
I think they're timely on different scales. First of all, the concept of robotics. Increasingly, the march of technology has automated things. I mean, the Industrial Revolution goes way back to the Industrial Revolution, where machines took over the production, which was previously done by hand. These days, much of our lives is run already by robots and artificial intelligence. An air traffic control system, for example, a pilot landing a plane, does so with the help of computer technology. And robots, of course, are being developed for, as we should be discovering in due course with Mary Ellen Foster, for social reasons. So people are wondering whether, with a crisis in the community care, or sorry, in the social care sector, We can't get enough home helps or staff in old people's homes and so on. Whether there actually is a function for a social robot that will, you know, not only make cups of tea, but actually will provide conversation. Now, some of us, if we want that, we get a dog, although we haven't yet trained a dog to make the cup of tea. But, you know, there is this very timely debate about, you know, in an aging population, who is caring for the aging population? And science is looking and investigating whether robotics can actually be part of that solution. But equally, people are worried that once upon a time, you know, they might have worked in a car factory, but now the robot puts the bits together. We know, for example, that there are going to be driverless vehicles, and they are being tested, and there are lots of ethical and insurance considerations around driverless vehicles. But actually, driverless vehicles also infer that there are workerless factories, because the robots are being built by robots. And yeah. So there is a very big debate in some quarters and concern generally that actually will the machines take over the world? And so this is one of the areas we want to look at. That's one of the reasons why robotics is such, and artificial intelligence is such a big thing at the moment. On the other questions, are we alone in the universe? This really strikes to a much longer consideration that people have. You look at the night, you know, anyone who's looked at a night sky, and you know, if you're fortunate enough to actually see the stars and the light pollution hasn't blocked that out, you do get a sense of wonder and purpose. And where are we? We're so insignificant. And then science increasingly reaching out with space probes and telescopes and satellites and all the rest comes back with this information that actually, folks, that there's new planets, there's new discoveries. And in many people's minds, this is unimaginable on one level, but it also, again, addresses the question, what are we? What is humankind? And more personally, how do I fit into this picture? So I think that, yes, that some of them are sort of longer-term considerations, robotics being a more modern one. But again, you know, when I'll be talking with Dr. Alistair McGrath about, you know, the conflict, where, you know, should we follow science? Well, that's a relatively new concept, isn't it? You know, we were told during pandemic, we must follow the science. We're not necessarily going to talk about COVID in our conversation, but this concept that science is the holder of truth. And if we were to believe the new atheist viewpoint, that science is the holder of all truth, then that is something which needs to be developed. It needs to be uncovered. It needs to be challenged. And in Dr. Alistair McGrath, we have not only a theologian, but also we have a doctor in science as well. So he's the ideal person to address that.
It looks like an absolutely fascinating lineup of both guests and topics, Nigel. Now, it's free to attend. People can just need to register, I think, to be part of this for these webinars. The place to go, of course, is the website christianevidence.org, where people can find the link and more info about this series. And will there be opportunity for people to take part themselves? Will there be a sort of Q&A element?
Yes, the format is very straightforward. We come online on the Tuesday, the four Tuesdays of March, starting at 8 o'clock. The first 40 minutes is a discussion which people can watch and be the audience of. And then during that discussion, people then are invited to use the Q&A format on the Zoom, put in their question. And then the last 20 minutes, I put viewers' questions to our guest. And we all learn from the whole hour, not only my questions, but those of the audience. We all learn something, hopefully new and insightful and exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to it. Questions of Our Times. That's the name of this series from the Christian Evidence Society, featuring Reverend Professor Alistair McGrath, Dr. Mary Ellen Foster, Professor Barbara Drossel, Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, fascinating questions that they'll be covering in Tuesdays throughout March. So get yourself booked in if you can at christianevidence.org. For now, thank you very much, Nigel, for being with
me. Pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being with us on this week's edition of Unbelievable. Just a reminder, your last chance to register for our Ask Philip Yancey Anything live webinar event this Tuesday, the 1st of March. You can attend from anywhere in the world absolutely free. Just go to unbelievable.live. And if you'd like details about the separate follow-up chat with Philip, I'll be hosting straight after the webinar for anyone who wants to support the launch of our new wider Premier Unbelievable Ministry, just email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or check out the link with today's show where you can register for that after party, as it were. And of course, links there for this year's Unbelievable Conference too. For now, thanks for being with us. Let me tell you what's coming up next time. Well, this is all in flux, and obviously the situation is developing every day, but I'm going to be working on a response to the Ukrainian invasion, looking at the religious dimension of this invasion and the tensions that have played out in the Eastern Orthodox churches alongside it. So look out for that on next week's edition of the show. Until then, stay safe and have a good week.